So this morning, I want to share some words of Suzuki Roshi, because I found a passage in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that says in a clear and simple way what I've been trying to say for the last 3 days. He says it in a couple pages. I wish I would have found that before. So I'll read this for you. It's from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. The purpose of my talk is not to give you some intellectual understanding, but just to express my appreciation of our Zen practice. To be able to sit with you in Zazen is very, very unusual. Of course, whatever we do is unusual because our life is so unusual. Buddha said, to appreciate your human life is as rare as soil on your fingernail. You know, dirt hardly ever sticks to your fingernail. Our human life is rare and wonderful. When I sit, I want to remain sitting forever. But I encourage myself to have another practice, for instance, to recite the sutra or to bow. And when I bow, I think, this is wonderful. But I have to change my practice again to recite the sutra. So the purpose of my talk is to express my appreciation. That is all. Our way is not to sit to acquire something. It is to express our true nature. That is our practice. If you want to express yourself, your true nature, there should be some natural and appropriate way of expression. Even swaying right and left as you sit down or get up from Zazen is an expression of yourself. It is not a preparation for practice or relaxation after practice. It's part of the practice. So we should not do it as if we were preparing for something else. This should be true in our everyday life. To cook or to fix some food is not preparation, according to Dogen. It's practice. To cook is not just to prepare food for someone or for yourself. It is to express your sincerity. And sincerity is a word that Suzuki Roshi used all the time. It wasn't a word that people used much then or now. But by sincerity, I think he means zenki. To cook is not just to prepare food for someone or for yourself. It is to express your sincerity. So when you cook, you should express yourself in your activity in the kitchen. You should allow yourself plenty of time. You should work on it with nothing in your mind and without expecting anything. You should just cook. That is also an expression of our sincerity, a part of our practice. It is necessary to sit in Zazen in this way, but sitting is not our only way. Whatever you do, it should be an expression of the same deep activity. We should appreciate what we are doing. There is no preparation for something else. The Bodhisattva's way is called the single-minded way, or one railway track thousands of miles long. The railway track is always the same. If it were to become wider or narrower, it would be disastrous. Wherever you go, the railway track is always the same. That is the Bodhisattva's way. So even if the sun were to rise from the west, the Bodhisattva only has one way. Her way is in each moment to express her nature and her sincerity. We say railway track, but actually there's no such thing. Sincerity itself is the railway track. The sights we see from the train will change, but we are always running on the same track, and there is no beginning or end to the track. Beginningless and endless track. There's no starting point, nor goal, nothing to attain. Just to run on the track is our way. This is the nature of our Zen practice. But when you become curious about the railway track, danger is there. You should not see the railway track. If you look at the track, you'll get dizzy. Just appreciate the sights you see from the train. That is our way. There is no need for the passengers to be curious about the track. Someone will take care of it. Buddha will take care of it. But sometimes we try to explain the railway track because we become curious if something is always the same. We wonder, how is it possible for the Bodhisattva always to be the same? What is his secret? But there is no secret. Everyone has the same nature as the railway track. There were two good friends, Choke and Hofuku. They were talking about the Bodhisattva's way, and Choke said, even if the enlightened one were to have evil desires, still, the Buddha does not have two kinds of words. I say that the Tathagata has words, but no dualistic words. And Hofuku said, even though you say so, your comment is not perfect. And Choke says, what is your understanding of the Tathagata's words? And Hofuku said, we have had enough discussion. Let's have a cup of tea. Hofuku did not give his friend an answer because it is impossible to give a verbal interpretation of our way. Nevertheless, as part of their practice, these two good friends discussed the Bodhisattva's way, even though they did not expect to find a new interpretation. So Hofuku answered, our discussion is over, let's have a cup of tea. This is a very good answer, isn't it? It's the same for my talk. When my talk is over, your listening is over. There is no need to remember what I say. There is no need to understand what I say. You understand. You have full understanding within yourself. There is no problem. So yesterday we were talking about Dharma culture. We were saying, just like he's saying here, our practice is not just meditation. We always change our practice. There's always a different practice. And all of the practice that we do is our culture. It's our Dharma culture. And every culture is basically a way of seeing and living life. You have your family culture. Nowadays, they say corporations have cultures. You might have an ethnic culture, a national culture. All these cultures are ways of life and ways of seeing and feeling life. A culture, you know, in a way, is kind of like a spell that you're in. Within certain cultures, certain spells, some things are possible and other things are not possible. Certain kinds of thinking will occur, and other kinds of thinking are impossible to have within those cultural spells. Sometimes you can wonder, it's disturbing, you know, to wonder, how could it be that a culture, for instance, a culture like Germany, during and before World War II, how could a culture do something like that? How is that possible? It's hard to understand because, of course, everywhere you go, people are more or less decent people. some more than others, but you know, in the generally, people are, you don't have like millions of evil people. People are pretty decent. So how could that happen? It's hard to understand how relatively ordinary, decent people could do such terrible stuff. And the only way I think you can understand it is to see that a culture is a kind of a spell. People are under a kind of a spell, and enthralled within that spell, it becomes impossible for someone to think, geez, this is crazy. This is crazy. We have to stop doing this. People can't have that thought. I mean, I'm sure many people there and then felt this somehow, but it couldn't just surface into thoughts. It certainly couldn't surface into words or deeds. Now, of course, to be sure, there are always some people who escape the spell, who do have these thoughts and words and deeds. But if the spell is strong enough, these very people end up serving the spell because they become vilified and ostracized, and they become examples of what's wrong and unacceptable. So they often end up reinforcing the madness even in their resistance. So cultures are spells. They can be toxic spells. Dharma culture, we hope, is a benevolent spell. A spell that promotes honesty, humility, compassion, awakening, and makes dishonesty, meanness more difficult. We hope it's that kind of spell. Anyway, nobody can be outside of a culture. We're all part of one or more cultures. So we're all in the thrall of one spell or another. So it's better to see through the pain of our cultures and decide to practice a culture that is beautiful and that will make your life and the world better. And we all, as I say, have many cultures we're part of. So let's make a Dharma culture one of our cultures. And let's hope that the Dharma culture will have an influence not only on us and our families and close-in people, but on the whole culture that we're living in now. Because the culture we're living in now is not necessarily a wonderful spell. It's difficult. There's a lot of suffering. And we are, by and large, I think, living in a culture of fear. I mean, fear is normal and natural. If you're human, there's going to be fear. But these days, not only in North America, but I think in a lot of other places in the world, we have like a highly developed culture of fear. Fear is reinforced and flung around everywhere. We're afraid of so many things. We're afraid of each other. We're afraid of the terrorists that we imagine. We need a gigantic establishment to make sure they're not around. Especially in the United States, we're afraid of the ordinary maniac with a gun. We're afraid of earthquakes and typhoons and floods and droughts and the wildfires that are still raging in California. Not only in the summer now, but all year round. We're afraid of the rising sea levels and the melting polar ice caps. We're afraid about economics. Everybody says the economies are booming. Really? What about tomorrow? How are we going to make ends meet in the future. And who can afford the rents in Vancouver or in any other major city where all the jobs are and you have to live there and you can't afford it? And the people who clean the buildings and take care of the food have to drive many hours because they can't afford to live there, clogging up the freeways and putting more carbon in the air. And there's so many people looking for those jobs in Vancouver. Are we going to be able to find a job when we get laid off from our job, as we inevitably will, at some point when there's a reorganization? Are there going to be enough jobs that pay the living wage? Most of the jobs now don't. And what about all these immigrants that are coming? Are they going to be taking our places? And it's worse in other places too, right, where there are droughts and total collapse, and people are leaving those places by the millions. Are they coming over here to Canada? All of them? And anyway, how hot can it get before life becomes unbearable? And will we be able to afford health care next year? And what about the next pandemic that we're not even thinking about now? And I could go on, right? Those are just the few things that I was worried about yesterday. So yes, we are anxious, we are nervous, we are fearful, and this unease has a bad impact on our everyday human relations, right? Never mind about like the people who are so-called normal. There's huge numbers of people with mental illness or severe addiction. And a lot of those people are in our families and in our workplaces. Sometimes we know it and sometimes we don't know it. And their problems are not their fault. They have just caught the disease that is flying around in the air. So we're all on edge. All of this makes us on edge all the time. And so we well may be out of sorts, you know, with our friends, with our spouses, with our siblings, with our parents, with our children. Not our grandchildren. But our children. And you know what? We might not even feel that great about ourselves. maybe we're the ones who are mentally ill and addicted, actually. Could be us. Probably, you know, to something. And you know what? We know we can't be trusted either. This world is so disturbing and uncertain that, you know, we can't even trust ourselves. How do we know? Because why is it that we're doing all these things to undermine ourselves all the time? Which we're doing, right? Things that make us unhappy, we're doing them. Even though we know better, we can't seem to help ourselves. And it is truly astonishing that in this time, when human beings know more and have more and more control of the material and even the psychological world than ever before, we seem to be more fearful than we ever have been before. And furthermore, we're so smart that we're absolutely convinced that all our fears are completely well-founded. Right? We're not just irrationally fearful. These things really are a problem. So I guess now we're getting into what you've been studying during your practice period, living in samsara, which really, in a way, comes down to how do you practice with fear. So Thich Nhat Hanh has a book called Fear, And I love Thich Nhat Hanh. He has been an important teacher for all of us, and surely one of the most influential teachers in the history of Buddhism, and certainly for our era. He came to the San Francisco Zen Center in the early 1980s. It was possibly his first visit to America, and immediately he attracted many students. That's when the beginning of his great influence in the West started. Just before he came there, I remember hearing that he had been on a big anti-nuclear weapons march in New York City. Many, 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 many thousands of people, you know, marching down those wide boulevards in Manhattan. And there were all these people marching rapidly ahead, a gigantic gap. And then Thich Nhat Hanh slowly walking along with thousands of people behind him, slowly walking at the same pace. There had been many, many peace marches before that, but nobody had ever seen anything like that before. I remember our abbot at the time, Richard Baker, Baker Roshi, who had been at that march with Thich Nhat Hanh, coming back, marveling over this and saying that Thich Nhat Hanh was a cross between a cloud and a tank. And he gave a great retreat at Green Gulch. And I remember, astonishingly, it was a small retreat. You know, we did it in the Wheelwright Center, which is a small room. Not many people can fit in that room. And every day he would speak to us. And we were amazed by his presentation of Zen, which was so much more gentle and straightforward than anything we had ever heard before. And later on, when he would hold retreats in America for thousands and thousands of people, it was amazing to think that in those days there were just a few of us there who had him all to ourselves. As a footnote here, I can recall that not long before that, the Dalai Lama also made his first visit to America, and he also came to Zen Center. And those of you from Victoria will, maybe you knew this already, but the Dalai Lama's assigned bodyguard was Wayne Codling. Did you know that? Yeah. Because Wayne was the toughest and meanest looking guy that we had around, so he was the bodyguard of the Dalai Lama. We were living at Tassajara at the time, so we missed that, but we heard about it. Anyway, so Thich Nhat Hanh is a great scholar and expert, you know, on all the Buddhist teachings, because he can read, unlike me and most of us in the West. He can read, you know, all these languages in which the sutras are, he can read the whole canon. So he is well aware of the complexity of all the Buddhist teachings, but in French and English anyway, his teaching is deceptively simple. I love Suzuki Roshi for this mystery of his style. He's also simple, but somehow you get the feeling that there's a lot lurking behind the words. You understand what he's saying and you don't understand. But Thich Nhat Hanh's words are also really simple, and there seems to be nothing lurking in the background. I think that a third grader could perfectly understand everything that Thich Nhat Hanh is teaching. And he often gives teachings to third graders, or Dharma talks to a mixed audience of adults and third graders, and everybody can perfectly well understand what he's saying. So that's a kind of amazing thing about him. So he writes this in his book called Fear. In our society, there is so much fear, so much suffering, violence, despair, and confusion. But there is also, at the same time, the beautiful blue sky. Sometimes the blue of the sky reveals itself to us entirely. Sometimes it reveals half of itself. Sometimes just a little bit of blue peeks through. And sometimes None at all. Storms, clouds, and fog hide the blue sky. But if we practice mindfulness, it's possible to be aware that even if the weather is very foggy, cloudy, or stormy, the blue sky is always there for us above the clouds. Remembering this keeps us from sinking into despair. If we know how to transform our despair, violence, and fear, the vast blue sky will reveal itself to us and to those around us. So in his simple way, Thich Nhat Hanh really has said a lot here. First, he's saying that we have to start by admitting that we do live in a culture of fear and despair and confusion. And it's tempting to either, on the one hand, try to deny this, to say it's all wrong, it's a mistake, it's a distraction, we can somehow leap over it. Or on the other hand, to take it so seriously and to work so hard to make it different that we're exhausted and we're in despair and we can't get out of it. But I think neither of these extremes will work. When fear is there, we can't run away or pretend. We have to feel fear. We have to look it in the face, even though it's the last thing in the world we want to do. When we're afraid, we have a lot of thoughts that seem reasonable. We will say, "Of course I'm afraid. I ought to be afraid. There's way too much carbon in the atmosphere. It's true. It's a catastrophe." Or, "My friend, my loved one really is in trouble. Bad things are going to happen." That's true. Or we might say, "Yes, the diagnosis I got yesterday was really bad. This is serious. I'm sunk." Since all these things might actually be true, we think it makes sense then to indulge our fear and that there is no other choice. But Thich Nhat Hanh says here, there might be storms and clouds covering the entire sky sometimes, and we don't see any blue sky, and we're going to feel completely desolate for a while. Yes. But behind the storms and clouds, there is always a blue sky, even if we can't see it. So, we have to have the capacity to talk to ourselves like a wise friend. We have to be able to say to ourselves, "Okay, I'm anxious, I'm fearful. Right now, I feel completely desolate, and that's the truth. But I know this feeling will only last for a certain amount of time. And me feeling this way will not reduce the carbon in the atmosphere, will not help my loved one, will not improve my health. In fact, if I keep on with this feeling longer than is absolutely necessary, it's only going to make these things worse. So, this feeling of desolation is natural. I don't need to disrespect myself for feeling it. But I know it's extra. Because I am a bodhisattva practitioner. Maybe I already took the precepts, so it is completely official. I really am a bodhisattva practitioner. I have a name and a lineage paper to prove it. I really am Buddha's disciple. And so I'm supposed to be a blessing for myself and everyone else. And how can I be a blessing if I go on too long indulging my fear? So I'm just going to have to stop. Yes, I know, there are clouds and storms. They will last for a while. But I also know there's a blue sky behind them. And this actually was a specific practice of Katagiri Roshi's. Once somebody asked him, what do you do when you're upset and in despair? And he said, I go outside and I look at the sky. Maybe he went out and looked at the sky and he saw some blue there. Maybe not. But I guarantee you that if you do this practice, if you when you are in despair, you go outside and look at the sky, it will change you. Maybe you'll still be upset, and maybe the conditions that cause you to be upset will be the same, but looking at the sky, you will feel somewhat different. Because the sky will absorb your pain. The air will absorb your pain. And just knowing that in your time of need, you have intentionally turned toward your practice, that this is who you are, that this is what you do, that, more than anything, will really help you. Or, if it seems like a good idea, you can sit. It can really help to sit in times of trouble. But if your mind is raging too much and sitting isn't good for you because it makes your mind rage even more, then get up and walk, especially outside. And there, the trees, no matter what's going on, I guarantee you, will not be upset. The sky, no matter what's going on, I guarantee you, will not be upset. The grasses will not be upset. Let them absorb your feeling. Or you can read a Dharma book. You can listen to a talk. In other words, there are lots of ways to take action to cope with your fear. It isn't right to just give in to it. You can do something. So fear is perfectly natural. We're built for it. But it isn't really ever reasonable. Because fear is always about the future. Even if, you know, right now, a big scary person walks in and we're afraid, it's because we're afraid that in the future this big scary person is going to hurt us. Right now, the person isn't hurting us. They just look that way. Or if I'm afraid because I found out I have a terrible illness, right now, I'm experiencing my life exactly as I was before experiencing it. The moment before I heard this news, really nothing has changed. My fear comes from what I fear will happen in the future because of what I just heard. That seems like it's reasonable, but it's not. Because no one can ever know what's going to happen in the future. No one can ever know. That's the nature of the future. It doesn't exist except as we have a thought about it now, in the present. When the future becomes the present, it's just like now. Right? It's just like now. There's pain, there's joy, there's life. There's whatever is going to be there. The future that has become the present is never, ever the same as the future we have imagined in the present. Even if we're imagining now that we're going to die, and we actually do die, the dying we will actually do will be absolutely nothing like the future dying we were fearing in a past present moment. It won't be, I can guarantee you. It will be entirely different. And guess what? We are going to die in a future moment. So if it were reasonable to worry about the future, we should be terrified each and every day. We should be terrified each and every moment. If that's reasonable to be fearing of the future, we should always be in the state of terror. Because there is absolutely no reason whatsoever that anybody sitting here right now won't die today or tomorrow. There is no good reason. It could happen. Every day, people who don't think on that day that they're going to die do. Every single day. It's the most common thing in the world. So it would be perfectly reasonable, if we think that fear is reasonable, to be terrified constantly. But somehow we're not, right? Somehow, like idiots, we are confident to be alive now. And that's always the truth. So a good practice, then, and this is what Thich Nhat Hanh recommends, a good practice to do when you're afraid, even when your reasons for being afraid are really good reasons, is to emphasize the present moment. This is what he's always saying, right? Breathe. You are alive. In this moment. This is Zenki, this is Zazen, right? Breathing in this present, profound, mysterious moment of being alive. So let's do just that, just for a minute. Just return to your breathing and feel what it's like to be alive for just this moment. And especially appreciate your breathing in with awareness of breathing in and breathing out with awareness of breathing out. Strong, slow, steady, beautiful breath. So this feeling of being alive and the well-being that automatically goes with it is available all the time. And it's profound because as we've been studying, this moment of being alive is immeasurably deep, all-inclusive, all-encompassing, placing us always at the center of life. To take refuge in the breath, to take refuge in the present moment of being alive, is to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, which is our true home. When we're breathing like this, we're home. And it's okay. Even if bad things happen, it's okay. Of course, bad things will happen, but when we're at home, bad things are not so bad. We can live them, and we can find some meaning in them, and we can find some love right in the middle of everything. Even if there's also anguish, there's love. Later on in the book, Thich Nhat Hanh speaks about the importance of community. He writes, "When we act as a community of practitioners, infused with the energy of mindfulness and compassion, we are powerful. When we are part of a spiritual community, we have a lot of joy and can better resist the temptation of being overwhelmed by despair. Despair is a great temptation in our century. And alone, we are vulnerable and afraid. If we try to go to the ocean as a single drop of water, we will evaporate before we arrive. But if we go as a river, if we go as a community, we are sure to arrive at the ocean, with a community to walk with, support us, and always remind us of the blue sky. We'll never lose our faith, and our fear will dissolve." In our world, for a long time, being in trouble, being in despair, being afraid was considered shameful. A good, strong person was always supposed to be okay. So if you felt any of these things, naturally, you would isolate yourself, you would pretend you didn't feel them, you didn't want anybody to ever know. So many people were suffering, and no one knew about it. Even their families didn't know. Used to be like that. Actually, it's still like that. It's still like that. The only difference is that now in our culture we have a space for some people to be very proud of their troubles and their despair and their fear. They can write blogs about it and memoirs, and they can have podcasts about it. It can be a whole career. You know, being in despair and having all kind of troubles. You can be on TV. And maybe that's healthier than before, but maybe also this becomes a kind of a new form of dishonesty. Somehow, by repeating endlessly what a mess I am and telling all my friends and everybody that I meet, maybe I can escape actually having to confront myself truly. And again, I think both these paths seem a little extreme. But it is true, you know, I think that my fear and trouble and despair are mine alone. Nobody else can take away that feeling. Nobody else can feel it for me. So that's why I have to be able to practice. I have to be able to make a big enough and safe enough space inside myself so that I can allow myself to feel what I need to feel. I'm not saying that we don't share our feeling. We should do that. We need to do it. It only means that we must cultivate the strength and dignity to feel our own feelings, and to know how to get the proper support for us to do that. In our sanghas, we can talk to our friends about what we're going through, and they'll understand, because they know that there is no shame in disaster. There's no shame in fear and despair. It's totally normal. in our Buddhist songs, we start with the proposition that we're all sad and vulnerable human beings. There are no other kinds of people that ever come to Buddhist sanghas. But also sometimes we don't need to talk to our sangha friends, or we don't need to talk to them constantly. We can feel their support without talking in the vast silence of the zendo, the silence that we carry with us in our hearts all the time. Even when there's noise outside, we can feel that support, even sometimes when we're far away from our sangha mates. In that silence, they're there, and they're supporting us. In the passage I just read, Thich Nhat Hanh uses this wonderful metaphor of a drop of water in the river. In another place in the book, when he's talking about community, he uses another metaphor. He says, if you throw a stone into the river, it will sink. But if you put many, many stones on a boat, you can sail that boat on the river and not a single stone will sink. So Sangha is our boat, the boat that Dogen mentioned yesterday. It protects us and it heals us. So after an entire lifetime of practicing with many Buddhist sanghas, I am here to tell you, in case you didn't already know this, that Buddhist sanghas are not made up of kind, wonderful, and perfect people. I think people are often quite disappointed when they hang around Buddhist sanghas because they thought that sanghas would be made of kind, wonderful, perfect people. No. Sanghas are made up of people like you and me, with we think more or less basically good hearts, but plenty of rough edges. As everyone now knows and probably expects nowadays, when everybody is so savvy about everything, wherever you see Sangha, you are going to see some conflicts, some bruised feelings, and possibly even some terrible pain. Everybody now knows this, and if you didn't know it before, you know it now. At least you heard it. But this is exactly what's important about Sangha. It's what makes Sangha so powerfully healing for us. Of all the Buddhist Sanghas I know, and I know many of them, around the country and around the world, of course, the sanghas that I know best are our everyday sanghas. And I can tell you that over the years, our sanghas have had our conflicts and bruised feelings and even our terrible pain. But I can also tell you, with all honesty, that I have been so impressed with the way that we have practiced with all this, with honesty, realistically, and with loving hearts. When we have, without really intending to, hurt one another, we have tried to understand. And where we could not as yet forgive and be friends again, we have worked anyway to hold one another in our hearts. And we have done this amazingly well, really. It is truly impressive and moving to me to see it. So it's all these cracks and patches that have been caulked, right, that make the boat stronger. So the boat is really sturdy. It's been through some stuff. So we can rely on it not to leak and bring us all the way to the other shore of peace and fearlessness. We've been working on this all these days, and before these days, all these years, and we will continue. Thank you very much for listening.
May our attention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I bow to them.